Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Judgment Day. Specifically, aesthetic judgment, objective aesthetic judgment, not your opinion versus my opinion, or our opinion versus their opinion, but the correct opinion. As objectively provable. And we're dividing it up, this homework assignment, which by now, if you don't have, you'll never have. The first 11 questions take us into the preliminary material that we have to judge. Not everyone, but most of those we have to judge. Those are the components on which we have to decide in order to ultimately reach the last four, which are the overall final judgments. So on the analogy of the Oscars, or the Tonys, I guess is more appropriate, we're first doing all the technical and supporting cast and so on awards, and then we're getting to the best play, the best comedy, etc. Now, a few introductory points before we plunge in. Basically, we're going to be taking up these 15 questions in order, and then I have several interesting questions written, and given that I want to give you a chance to interject your comments, we should run well into 2 o'clock. But I'll stop at 12:30 anyway. Now, the purpose of our discussion today is really a small-scale example of evaluation in real life. And the point I want to make at the outset is that evaluation entails comparison. If you ask such a simple question about a man as, is he hardworking, which other things equal is a virtue, you have to know, what do you mean by hardworking? In relation to what standard? Does he work harder than Rourke? Does he work about like Eddie Willers? Does he work like I did last year, only 2 days a week? Now, aesthetic evaluation similarly requires for clarity an implicit comparison among different artworks within the same genre. For example, if you want to judge, does this have a good climax, this play? That absolutely depends, your ability to answer. It depends on your knowing, on your concretizing, well, what is a mediocre climax? What is a poor climax? What is a truly great climax? In other words, you have to have implicitly in your mind a scale or spectrum of better or worse on which you can then locate a given climax. So this is not an artificial academic exercise where we just are comparing 7 great plays because we couldn't think what else to do with the 8th. In pattern, this should give you some guidance for aesthetic evaluation throughout life. Another introductory note here. We are judging these plays within the framework of the exact title of this course. I picked every word that was in and out of the title. We are evaluating these plays as philosophy and as literature. Putting it negatively, we are not evaluating them as dramatic spectacles. In other words, not as theater, not as enacted plays on the stage or screen. The theatrical form of art uses a different medium. The medium of theater is actually human bodies moving on stage and speaking. It's not the printed play script, which is simply concepts or language, in other words, literature. Theatrical performance is an event which involves a whole new category of issues in judgment, which I don't purport to know a great deal about. But you would have to take into account an awful lot of factors that are not purely literary. For instance, the visual spectacle of the stage, the costuming, the time compression, pace, movement, color, physical transition, smoothness, There's all kinds of things that go into making an effective or great dramatic spectacle that are just simply not part of the discussion if what you're talking about is plays as literature that you read. In other words, essentially as novels, but with only dialogue and no exposition or comment by the author. This is not irrelevant to judging great plays, because you'd have to judge the play as literature in order to know how good the performance actually could be when it's enacted. But this is really just a stage in a still more complicated undertaking, and this is thankfully is enough for us. Now, my last introductory note, I have created a fallacy, which I call the modernocentric predicament. And this fallacy occurred to me when my preliminary seminar for this course was given a list of questions. And lo and behold, every play, which was the best, whether philosophically, aesthetically, as a whole, personally, it didn't make any difference. It was always Joan of Arc, Enemy of the People, or more commonly, Mona Vana. Always. And I thought to myself, this was really suspicious. There's four old plays and three modern plays. And isn't it a funny coincidence that they all love the three modern plays? Now, this disappointed me, I have to say frankly, because my goal as teaching this course is to broaden your receptivity. I think it's a terrible fate, a needless constriction, to confine yourself to the last 100 or so years of a declining civilization, which has lasted for 2,500 years with its greatest genius before our time. So if your estimates come out endorsing predominantly plays from Ibsen on, then I feel safe in saying you have this problem. You're trapped in the modern perspective, in the ease of getting into a modern play. And probably the two factors that would trap you in that is your age and your education. Age functions because as you get old enough, you finally reach a state of thorough disappointment with most contemporary stuff. And you're willing to put in the time and effort necessary to open up the great classics of the past. Education comes in because one of the purposes of education should be to make great literature from the past accessible. And of course, they do the opposite today. They either keep you in ignorance of it, or else they present it in such a way that you run for your life for the rest of your life. I want to repeat one propagandistic point that I mentioned earlier. If your modernocentric attitude were sustained, and I don't mean every one of you has it, but I'm sure enough of you do, it would mean that 3,000 years from now, people would be justified in saying, oh, I don't want to bother to read Ayn Rand, that all that archaic stuff about telephones, what's a telephone? You know, and have to read footnotes on the bottom of the page and talk about railroads and things, and they're going to be constant explanatory texts in the back. Why can't I just plunge into something good and racy from my own time? And you would by this method actually never get to read Ayn Rand. The language would be archaic. And yet what a tremendous value you would have lost thereby. And I think a parallel to that is true right now. If you cannot get what Greek literature or Renaissance literature has to offer, you are missing an immortal value. So watch your own answers. Any given answer, it's okay, but if you're completely skewed on the side of the last three plays in this course, you have already committed this fallacy. Now, I also want to remind you that we did not show a movie or enact a play of six of the seven works in this course. For people who are hearing this on tape, we did see a movie of St. Joan. That must, however, not sway you, because we could have theoretically done it for all. Do not bring in your memory of the movie, however much you liked or disliked it, as part of your analysis here. That is not admissible as evidence in this court. All right, you have to take out your crow summaries of the seven plays, so you have them right beside you. Antigone, Othello, Le Cid, Don Carlos, Enemy of the People, St. Joan, and Mona Vaughan. And with each, you have the characters, the plot theme, the climax, the theme, and the overall philosophy. And we can skim it up and down if we need to ask questions or to make comments. Now let's plunge in with number one. Who was the strongest heroine in all these plays? And generally speaking, I'll give you my thoughts first. It would be more fun to elicit all kinds of different thoughts from you first, but we would never begin to start that way. So I'm going to first of all give you my views on these, and then I'm happy within the limits of time to take your comments. The strongest heroine in my judgment, I'm not going to keep saying in my judgment, but that's obviously implied, is Antigone. I don't think there is a second that's equally strong. And I gave my reasons for that in discussing her. She is the one most like Ayn Rand, and to me that is a self-evident proof of strength. Now, for second, I have Joan and Chimène tied for different reasons. Joan has a lot of really good qualities, a stressed idealism, youthful self-confidence. She is actually more of an initiator than Antigone. Antigone waits for the order and then reacts to it. Joan comes out of the blue with her own plan, and she has a wider scale of achievement, which, as you'll see, counts for a great deal in these things. She takes on the entire world, leads armies, and so on. The problem with Joan, as I've said over and over in discussing it, is can you believe in her fully? There is this Shavian ambiguity of Joan as a human being, with all the virtues, and Joan as a super personal manifestation of a cosmic power that also manifests itself in miracles and the mystical. And that edge takes her out of the category of being the strongest to me. It's an act of abstraction. You have to look away and just imagine what she would be if she were fully what she is. Now, similarly, but for a completely different reason, I would put Chimène as less strong than Antigone. Now, it's not there any ambiguity in her character, but that we do not have a really full presentation of Chimène. Largely, her character is presented, not totally, but largely, significantly, as love-oriented. Now, there is a significant element of Chimène facing reality, facing the king, facing the court, arguing down the Infanta. So it's not only in relation to Roderigue that we see her, but dominantly, it's her love for Roderigue that is the focus. And what we want in a strong character is, above all, a character facing reality, and therefore implying the enormous potency of being able to do whatever he or she sets out to do. By somewhat delimiting the scope and development of Chimène, which the play required him to do, he doesn't make her the full heroine that Antigone is, who takes on all comers, and you see her fully flourishing in action. So Chimène has tremendous power, but as I say, for a different reason than for Joan, I put her second. Now, Mona Vaughan, I put third here and last of the good females, specifically because she is not metaphysically developed at all except by implication. She's entirely love-oriented. The whole question in her mind is, this man or that man? Now, it implies certainly strength, and she's willing to take on the city, and there's no doubt that a great strength is implied. But the problem with Monavana in this regard is a full-blown version of what we have partially with Shemin. She's much too much for full depiction of strength, too much a romance-oriented character rather than a reality-oriented character, which includes romance as one part of it, the way Antigone did. And so to me, there's no question that objectively, the strongest heroine in all these plays is Antigone. Now, before I get your view, let's finish the other two parts of question one. The most admirable hero. And here I have no doubt in saying that it is Lacide. Rotary. This man has strength, independence, and achievement on a larger-than-life scale. He is a truly glamorous, romanticized figure. He's a colorful hero. He savors every moment of his life. I think, and this is a kind of a good test, it would be a pleasure to be friends with him. Now the question is to compare him to his closest rival. And I think Thomas Stockman would be next in order as the most admirable hero. But Rodriguez is more unique a character than Thomas Stockman. He is morally innocent, like Stockman, but he's not naive, or at least he's not so naive as Thomas Stockman. Plus, there's no element of him being a martyr to a world that doesn't understand him. He is a conqueror, not only in intention, but in fact. And this is despite the fact that he perhaps offers his life one time too many to Shemin. Now, Thomas Stockman has all the same virtues in essence as Lacide, the same strength, but he is somewhat downsized, I think. Not undercut, but just reduced in stature by the comedic overtones of the play. Now, both Corneille and Ibsen project an enjoyment of life, but the pleasure of Corneille, that joie de vivre, is not undercut or reduced in any way by silly touches or clowning around. It's kind of a sheer, exalted exuberance, and that is not matched by Ibsen in the play, and for that reason, if I have to say the most admirable hero, the one I would most look up to, it would be Lacide. Now, the worst villain, I don't think there's even a debate. Without a doubt, by 40 lengths, Iago. We've already discussed why. This is the hater of everything that's good and the destroyer of everything that's good. I would not put even the Grand Inquisitor, who is pretty wicked, the one in Schiller, I would not put him in the same league. He is not a nihilist. The Grand Inquisitor has definite views. He has a whole coherent philosophy. And in some sense, on some level, he believes it and he lives by it. And that is miles above Iago, whose attitude would be modern nihilism. He doesn't want ideas. He thinks ideas are just a ruse to trap the unwary, just a game. So the Grand Inquisitor has a certain stature. Iago is at the very bottom of the pit. So for these reasons, I come out with Antigone, Lacide, and Iago. And I happen to think that those are the three most memorable characters in the seven plays. When time goes by, and you forget the lesser characters or the mixed characters, the undeveloped characters, the ordinary ones, these three portraits have a force, I'll come back, for good or evil, that will be like someone you will know for the rest of your life. And that is a very important issue in a play. Well, also, just before I get to you, let's go on a bit more with a couple of these questions on character. And then after we've done our little section on characters, the first four questions, I'll ask for what you think. So let's go to question two. Which character has the strongest motivation? In other words, the most intense passion, the most inflexible will. Now here we're talking about a specific aspect, not so much just who's the strongest, who's the most admirable, but who is specifically the most intense in pursuing their goal, intense and inflexible. And for practical purposes, since you can't really measure these, I would list three as pretty much tied on this count. Antigone, Lucide, and Dr. Stockman. Because he may be downsized by the comedic element, but he is certainly inflexible. He certainly has an intense passion. And so those three, I think, are unequivocal. Chimène, as we said in class, is in a sense even stronger than Lucide. So you can put her in if you want. The reason I haven't is only because she's not, as I say, fully developed in the play. So we don't get to see as much of her motivation because she's just... He conquers Arabs. He conquers the world. I mean, this is a truly metaphysical character. And Chimène basically conquers him, which in its own way is definitely a feat. But she's not as integral to world-scale action, so we don't have as much chance to judge her passion, not as full a display of it. Now, where do I put Joan here? Well, absolutely she's in the running. Counter number one, if you can abstract away from the ambiguities. If it's really her passion and her will and not just the cosmic will of German philosophy. What about Mona Vanna? Well, she certainly implies full-scale heroism and intensity of passion. But again, we do not see it. We see only her romantic intensity. We don't see world-scale passion or will. Now, I want to make a theoretical point here that I think is of some importance. What counts in evaluating heroism broadly and in evaluating intensity, passion, will more specifically, is not only the inner alone, not only the passion and force of the inner dedication, but the objective external scale of the conflict or the achievement. After all, the purpose of motivation is what? Now, what's the purpose of holding value judgments and inflexibly clinging to them? To achieve something in action, to do something. And Aristotle said, and Ayn Rand agrees, nothing is more important than what the characters do. Now, from this point of view, they all have to do something, and in a great play, of course, they all do something, and Don Carlos, who does virtually nothing, is a wimp for that reason, the character. But granted that they all do something, the way that you judge in conjunction with the rest of the context is the scale of what they do. And let me give you just a common sense analogy here. Without meaning to be unduly self-effacing, but I think this is a good analogy. Let us say you regard me as heroic for learning objectivism and Ayn Rand as heroic for creating objectivism. And I put to you the two cases as an objective test. Who comes out as the strongest The student who struggles sincerely for decades to master a philosophy and finally does so, or the master who created the philosophy, perhaps much faster and with less sustained agony of inner chaos. Now, you measure that definitely by saying, well, look, when the chips are down, she thought of it. She did it. You know, that's not to take away from what a student has done, but the scale, the sheer breathtaking dimensions of the action are not irrelevant to whether you call this strength or whether you call this passion or what you call it. Now, I want to bring in here the broader theory. Art is perceptual, and therefore a world-scale achievement, a huge scope in the character's actions, has the ability to bring the metaphysical perspective directly to the perceptual level. If you get anything done, I would get that done. A world-scale achievement brings the metaphysical perspective that we seek from art directly to the perceptual level. You see the hero fighting the world, and if it's a benevolent play, beating the world, as opposed to merely beating a rival. And this is the primary reason why I require a play to be philosophical in order to be great. Because a philosophical play most obviously fulfills this need of art. It concretizes the metaphysical and thereby condenses an entire view of life to your percepts. It reveals the full potentiality of human passion, the full scope of its operation facing the entire world of society. And this is why a philosophical quality gives a play and a character, in my opinion, greater power to either uplift you profoundly or depress you utterly. If the play and the character are on a world scale, they thereby bring to the perceptual level the profoundest character values. Now, of course, I hasten to say that, of course, all art is implicitly metaphysical. And I don't deny that. But a philosophical play is special in this regard, because it conveys the added power of the explicit over the implicit. Now, I do not mean, please underscore this, I do not, N-O-T, mean that a play has to be like Atlas Shrugged and have a lengthy speech or any speech synopsizing its view of metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics, and so on. Let's say that there's a continuum. And one extreme is Atlas Shrugged at the Fountainhead, which are have avowed philosophic revolutions and summarize their philosophies as part of the script or as part of the work. On the other extreme would be what I call one-note plays or one-theme plays, like Mona Vanna, You Should Be Selfish, or The Miracle Worker, The Importance of the Senses. And all the way on the of that extreme would be, you know, the standard detective stories and comedies, which also have an implicit metaphysics, but no particular abstract theme at all, except let the good triumph, you see. Now, in the middle, I hate to use that word, but I don't know any other way to put it, between philosophic texts on the one hand and one-note plays on the other are the most of the plays in our course. That is Shakespeare, Corneille, etc. Those are not filled with philosophic speeches which express their viewpoint the way Atlas is, but they are much more than simply one-note themes. They actually present to you in the course of the action, the dialogue, etc., a total philosophy in its bare bones essence. And it's what I'm talking about when I say that I attach so much importance to a philosophical play is only in the sense in which six of our seven plays were philosophical plays, even though none of them were philosophical the way Atlas Shrugged is. They're all much more philosophical than, for instance, The Miracle Worker or Who Killed... what's that Agatha Christie title? Who Killed Roger Ackroyd? Right. All right. This is by way of still explaining why I give the strongest motivation to a world-scale conflict or a world-scale action. Now, in regard to passionate motivation, well, before we leave that, there are three characters that I would not allow anywhere near the top rung. So if you chose them, I think you're wrong. Number one, Iago. Iago has an urge to destroy. And when he sees that his course is doomed, he just quits. He simply turns off and says, to hell with it, I'll never speak again. This is not a man of passion. Nihilism is not a passion. And I think if you knew Iago, you would find him a very emotionless, cold fish. The great Iagos on stage do not twirl their mustache and slaver saliva down, you know, and this incredible theatrical melodrama. They are repressed, quiet. The whole idea is that Othello has to take him as honest Iago. He's got to be mild. And they are that way in real life. You should be only so lucky that depraved people come across the way they are. They may be seething with revenge down in their soul, but what you see and what they primarily feel is boredom. And they get a little flicker of glee when they stick the knife in someone. So if we're talking in serious terms about an intense passion and inflexible will, Iago is simply out of the picture. The same is true for Othello. Any character whose action contradicts his passion loses if the contest is who is the most passionate. Because we judge passion in large part by action. And you can say, I love her till the skies come home. And if you can nevertheless smother her when she's sleeping, that is a really grave indictment of the passion of your passion. So anybody who contradicts in action retroactively his passion was not of the stature that you thought. And this happens to be a very true and important point in life. You never have to be in the problem of this person loved the good or loved objectivism so passionately I can't figure out why he went and joined the Rotary Club, or whatever is the opposite of it. And the answer is, if that's what he did, I don't mean the Rotary Club, but if that's what he did, you can see that you were wrong in thinking that he was that passionate to begin with. Words are cheap. It's very easy to put on an act of excitement. But it's the course of your action, especially across decades. This is what made Aristotle, who went a little too far with this point, decide that you can't say that a man is happy until he dies, because you never know what's going to happen in the next week. Now, I wouldn't go that far, but certainly a couple of decades of fidelity is very helpful. Now, for the same reason, Posa absolutely is out as far as having the most intense passion. Because, however inflexibly committed he is, so it seems, he permits his neurotic self-image as a big shot leader to eclipse his passion for freedom and tempt him into becoming a dictator in regard to Don Carlos. And that is so grave a lapse, even if it's a momentary one, that he's just out of the running as far as a passionate character is concerned. All right, and a couple now. We've pretty much exhausted the character mind here, but just to finish off 3 and 4 quickly, these 3 and 4 are really results of your answers to 1 and 2. And I have to answer as a man, the one I would most like to sleep with is number 1, Antigone. No doubt in the world, she's the strongest. She has the strongest motivation. Second to her, I would put Shaman. Now, Mona Vanna, I would not be interested in. She is not a three-dimensional character to me. She's too definitely a romantic heroine. So I feel I know her in relation to the man she loves, but I don't know her. I don't know her soul in relation to the world. It's suggested, but not... So it's the same point over again. And Joan is just too drab for me. I mean, I certainly understand her reason for not getting dressed. You know, but I just do not go for an androgynous character. Now, if you are a woman, I can just say that Well, let me see if you're the same as the people in the seminar. How many of the women in this class, just by a show of hands, chose as their number one choice Princey Valley? Yeah, well, that's pretty decisive. Did anybody choose Dr. Stockman? Well, you see, he's not a romantic hero, I grant you. Did anybody choose Hyman? Dr. Packer? And over here, a couple. Now, the only thing, this is obviously is a completely free question. You don't get any points off for this. Did anybody choose Dunois from Shaw? Not one taker for this gallant military commander? So who else did you choose if you were a woman? Oh, I forgot about Lacide completely. Yes. How many of you chose Lacide? Oh, let me ask you another question. Why did you choose Princey Valley over Lacide? What did you say? He's sexier. Why? Wait, put your hands up and tell me why you think. I mean, I have to judge this from your perspective, but why did you... I want a woman to answer this. Why is Lacide and Princey Valley sexier? Now, Princey Valley is sexier in the sense that the action of the play revolves around his desire to sleep with this woman, and he wants her to come naked under her cloak, etc., etc., whereas Lacide is really oriented around the Arabs and riding off on his horse, etc. But I mean, that's just the glimpse of two portraits. We could just as well have taken Princey Valley, who was a professional soldier and caught him in the middle of a war and so on, and followed Lacide, if the rules of classicism had allowed it, into the boudoir and heard him making love. Would that have changed your mind? How many of you feel more at home with Princey Valley because you are afraid that Lacide would talk poetry to you? Well, that is an acceptable point. If you think that Shemaine comes across as stronger than Lacide, you want the top strongest possible. However, I think, without wanting to debate this point, you would have your work cut out to say that Hyman is stronger than Lacide as an objective proposition, because one of the usual comments on this play is that Hyman is not strong enough for Antigone and that she would devour him in real life. So There is, however, I don't think we have to hit this one into the ground. Let's go to number four. I'm only an hour behind now. Antigone. Oh, I didn't try to answer that. An essential thing about philosophy is you have to know the limits of inference. Otherwise, it's rationalism. And now, which character number four do you most like? That is, leaving aside sexual. And here, it was Antigone or Lyside. I could not choose between them. I thought they were the two most memorable of the positive characters. It would be literally impossible for me to tell. A close second here in terms of a character I liked is Dr. Stockman, for his many good qualities and the fact that he has such good ideas. But I do definitely put him as a second because he's not a character of the standing and the stature of those two. Now, this is really a consequence or summation of your previous judgments, but I just wanted to get it down because it's very important to your final evaluation of a play. What about the characterization? Does it create the kind of character that sears itself on your consciousness for good or evil? If it does, that's a monumental aesthetic achievement, not philosophic. Aesthetic achievement within a literary form that has characters. If you can create a character with the resonance and the power to fill your consciousness as a unique and strong or unique and monstrous and still credible, that in itself is a tremendous achievement. Nothing can be a great play completely if it doesn't approach this. Now, I think in all of our plays we have some characters that would conceivably qualify, but the ones I would pick out as the obvious great characterizations are Antigone, Lyside on the positive, and Iago on the negative. All right, I've got a couple of minutes. Would you like to essentially contest or volunteer a new point or ask a question with regard to characterization before we plunge on? I tried to anticipate everything you would say. Go ahead. Now, you're not going to read a long essay, right?
No.
Okay.
As to the characters with whom I would like to sleep, I thought the best couple was... Well, I mean, not necessarily picking couples in the same play, but Vanna and Principale. And the reason I picked them is because of the, I think, in my psyche, I do see the sexual attractiveness of the dominant submissive mode. Mm-hmm. And I see that very strongly between
those two.
That's
a good point. It's a good point. The dominant submissive mode is essential to sexuality, and Lyside is a little too submissive to Chimène. And there's not many other couples. But the other thing, I mean, that have that quality in our plays, the other thing is that play is about sleeping together. The whole thing in that play orients you to an erotic message. And the very last line is, okay, I'm off to the cell. Lie down and get ready. So that, in effect, eroticizes the whole play. All right, now with that helpful comment, I'm going to go on to the series of questions about story. That's 5 through 8. Starting with, which play has the most ingenious plot theme, action situation? And here, I could not choose between two plays, and much as I tried to avoid the modernocentric predicament in order to give you a good object lesson, I had to say that the two best were Lyside and Mona Vanna. Two best plot themes. Now, of those two, I think Mona Vanna is a little lesser. It's because it's a little more conventional. It's the kind of thing you could see Hollywood ripping off. But I do say Maeterlinck presented it so well that the situation itself is tremendously suspenseful. So I give the edge to Lacide, but what these two plays have in common, and I want to stress this, is an artificial situation. A good play, a good plot theme, is not a natural, everyday type occurrence. Artificial is a compliment in aesthetic judgment, not an insult. Remember in We the Living, talking about scenery, Lydia looks at the stage and says, oh, how beautiful, it's almost real. And Kira looks at it and says, oh, how beautiful, it's almost artificial. And Ayn Rand was trying to make the point there that art has to be artificial. What does artificial mean? In this context, deliberately chosen every aspect to achieve the purpose of the artist. Not just taken from life because that's the way it is, but stylized and slanted and selected so the force of a human mind and human purpose is controlling it. It's made by art, artificial, as opposed to just happening. Now, these two have artificial situations, and I repeat, I don't mean unbelievable or anything like that, but situations deliberately constructed for passionate, unusual conflict. The others, for whatever their genius, as sheer plot theme, are basically simple stories of a man or woman who asserts himself against a hostile world. But here we have a worked-out situation of conflict, which is complex, entirely credible, but not common. Ingenious, that's the word. It's not common in the sense that I rebel against people is common. Now, Lacide is the best because it's pure ingenuity and sets up a conflict far beyond the conventional. You see, in the Mona Vanna play, a man wants to sleep with another man's wife. That's a good conflict. But that is not yet a great conflict. For him to have to kill her father in order to deserve sleeping with her, that is even better. And here you can compare Atlas Shrugged, where the plot is very much like Lacide. Not in concretes, but I mean on this level that we're talking about. It's the difference that if Dagny were merely torn between Reardon and Galt, that would be a conflict of a woman having to choose between two men. But if she's torn between her railroad and Galt, that is a much more unique and unconventional conflict. Especially if her railroad is what her lover is destroying, and on top of that, it's her supreme value which she needs in order to feel that she is worthy of his love. And yet it's he is her love and she's ruining the very thing that she needs in order to feel this is what she wants in life, and therefore she wants to sleep with him. So Dagny is put through hell. And Lacide is, as you see, is like a feudal version of that same plot theme. I hope Ayn Rand doesn't rise from the grave and strike me dead. But I do think that Lacide has by far the best, the most ingenious plot theme of all seven. And that is a really major consideration. Because you know that Ayn Rand was asked to, in an interview once to name the three most important things about literary work. And you know what her answer was? Plot, plot, and plot. And of course, plot theme is your key to plot. Now you see, in relation to Lacide, Enemy of the People is not ingenious. I'm not putting it down in any way, but it's a man gets mad at society or takes a stand against society. Antigone is not an ingenious plot, I'm not blaming Sophocles. They just barely got the idea of telling a story, let alone, you know, a complicated artificial plot where every step puts you in conflict with somebody else. And Othello is certainly not a complex plot, and Shakespeare disdained plot. He took over, you know, whatever tales he could find, and then he embellished them with poetry and character. But the plot of Othello is just a guy gets jealous. Don Carlos is just too long and overcomplicated to qualify. A great plot must be ingenious, true, but also simple, essentialized, so that even a child can grasp it, as long as the child knows what love is. If a child doesn't know what love or lovemaking is, they don't have access to the world's great literature. So they have to get to the stage, they don't have to know the mechanics of intercourse, but they have to know there is such a thing as love that's really, really important to people. And you can, if you're explaining it to your child, you can say it's like bubble gum or, you know, something that they can translate it into their own terms. Now, what about Shaw here? Shaw's play is very ingenious. It's ingenious in his ability to interweave historical ideologies like nationalism and Protestantism into the story. But the story as such is just pure history. There's no ingenuity in the plot situation. She's hates what's going on, and she's martyred. So it's per se, it's a straightforward story. All right, now, the strongest conflict, that's number six. Now, I've stressed over and over again that a play stands or falls with the depth of its conflict. And of course, that will reflect both the type of plot situation, the type of conflict that's possible, and the type of characters. And here I think there are two different conflicts that qualify as best, and it's not surprising that both derive from what I think are the strongest plot themes. Roderigue versus Chimène, or Guido versus Prince Zavalli. Now, the reason I choose these two is that neither party in these two cases bends, breaks, or gives up, not to the bitter end. Nothing stops them, even when the play is over. They're still at war. Now, but of these two, I take Lacide versus Chimène as the best conflict in the seven plays on two grounds. One is, it's the only conflict between purely good characters, as against one character being good and the other being evil or weak, or as Guido is, pretty ordinary. And here the principle is the impotence of evil. The strongest clash is always between the most heroic characters. And we've already discussed how in both Atlas and The Fountainhead, Miss Rand centers her conflicts around the positive characters. The other reason that I take Lacide versus Chimène as the strongest conflict is that the strongest external conflict, in other words, the strongest conflict with the outside world, is one which can withstand and endure in the face of the character's inner conflict. If a man has an inner crisis tearing him apart, and he still remains inflexible in action, then that shows how completely passionate his outer commitment is. And that's what makes the conflict between Roderigue and Chimène so intense, that they're completely torn by conflict. They each love each other, and part of them wants to just throw aside the feudal requirements and just go to bed with each other. And yet they're utterly adamant about their course. And so this makes the passion of their conflict truly awesome. Now, you see, Guido and Prince Zavalli have much less inner conflict. Prince Zavalli is unconflicted, basically speaking. And Guido has some doubts, but not much. So their dedication is less dramatized. They have less of an inner obstacle or hurdle. And therefore, their interaction is less awe-inspiring. Now, there's a lot of other possibilities which I think are not as good a conflict, but nevertheless, certainly, all these, I reiterate, are great plays. And therefore, they've got to have a great conflict in somewhere. So it's a question of degrees on a scale. Dr. Stockman versus the mob. Now, the only problem with that conflict is that the mob is too collective to be an entity. Conflict is always strongest between separate individuals that you get to know rather than one individual against a mob which doesn't have that clear and firm an identity in your mind. Antigone versus Creon. This is an excellent conflict, but the problem is he is too weak. Not too weak for a great play, but too weak for the ideally powerful conflict. He capitulates suddenly and then grovels. Iago versus Othello. Again, Othello is too weak. He's taken over too easily. Now, if we could allow such a conflict as Iago versus the good, that would be a great conflict. But the trouble is that good would then be a floating abstraction in that formulation, and there's no character in the play that represents the good. Now, as far as Don Carlos, I do not believe any of the positive characters in the play, Don Carlos, are heroic enough to qualify here. Don Carlos himself is a whim worshiper, and Poza, as I've already indicated, has a major weakness, and that just takes him out of the league. All right, let's go to seven. We have to hustle along for a few minutes here. Which conflict has the most gripping climax and the most dramatic ending? Now, those are two different questions. Climax pertains to when the strands come together and you finally reach the culminating event which decides who's going to win or lose. And then the ending is the resolution. That's where you see worked out in detail the winning or the losing, and can have a whole life in tremendous suspense of its own. So this is not the same question. Now, I reached the best climax by elimination here. That's the only way I could do it. It's definitely not Joan, St. Joan, because the climax is much too theoretical, and a play is action. The climax in Joan is scene four, the intellectual agreement between the clergy and the nobility, which is a purely intellectual event, and it pertains to minor characters on top of it. Now, of course, Shaw never attempted to write a well-made play, but unfortunately he succeeded, and therefore I have to judge him accordingly. Now, I don't think the climax in Antigone qualifies because it's just barely a climax. The climax is her resolve not to give in. And that is just like a final reaffirmation or statement. It's not a new event, a specific event, a visually gripping event. I don't think the climax of La Cid, which is the king elevating Rodrigue to the title of La Cid, that is more ceremonial than an action or a visual occurrence. It's more talk than action, as it comes across in reading. Now, I leave open the idea that I could conceive a director who would stage this coronation, in effect, with such excitement and solemnity and music and everyone bowing into the dust, radiance, etc., that it's an event. You say, oh my God, this guy, I can see him elevated to king of the universe. But in reading, it goes right by, you know. He says, you're La Cid, great, on to the next. So as climax, it doesn't come across in reading. Mona Vanna, too predictable. If a climax is 100% predictable, it's out as a gripping climax. And if we know from the moment that the play starts, if she doesn't fall in love with Prince Ivali in Act Two, there's no play. So the three best climaxes by elimination are Don Carlos, The Death of Poza. That is a gripping and unexpected event, but perfectly logical within the structure of the play, as we've seen. Enemy of the People, a confrontation with the mob. Excellent climax. But in my judgment, the top one, the most gripping climax, is Othello. And here I think you see the true genius of Shakespeare, power of visualization. I remind you that according to objectivism, art reduces concepts to the perceptual level. It's a visual recreation of the sense of life. Now, the climax is not just that Iago wins over Othello in the temptation scene, because that would be merely an internal character change. The brilliance, the really magnificent brilliance of this climax is the two kneeling side by side in a religious ceremony, dedicating themselves solemnly to the death of Desdemona. Now, this is not just, okay, I changed my mind. This is an eloquent action, externalized, visualized, yet much subtler than such obvious events as a death or a mob scene. It's a climax that could work only in the hands of a master artist. But in his hands, it's more gripping, I think, than the more conventional action climaxes. Now, as to the most dramatic ending, I don't think there's a choice in the world. Hands down to Don Carlos. I don't think anything tops those last two scenes, the Grand Inquisitor, followed immediately by the king saying to Don Carlos, it is your last action curtain. Nothing in world literature that I know tops that as the ending of a play. And that's why I included the play. If drama means a clash that is both unpredictable, inevitable, devastating, profound, and then we throw in that it's philosophically all-encompassing, and that all of that should take place with the speed of a telegram or a single sword stroke, I can't even conceive what could surpass the ending of Don Carlos. Antigone, I think, has a very powerful ending. In a way, you could say that Antigone is the most tragic ending, because I care more about her. It has a soul-searing ending. It's the only one at which I regularly cry. But it's not dramatic in this unpredictable and yet devastating way. You know from the outset what's going to happen. And it's simplified. St. Joan, the epilogue, has too much farce, I think, to undercut real sustained drama. It has a powerful situation, but it's Shaw clowning around, and I think it does hurt his power. Mona Vanna, very dramatic ending, but not on the world scale of Schiller's play. It's the same issue here as with the admirable character or the intensity of motivation. Scale or scope is a crucial factor. Now, Le Cid, which I really like as a play, I do not regard as having a dramatic ending, and that's a flaw. It's too unexplicit, as we've discussed. It's undoubtedly positive, but it's not entirely clear what's happening. Enemy of the People is too futuristic to be dramatic. He just sits down and says, well, in the generations to come, things will get better, but it's not like someone has just dropped an atom bomb and closed the curtain. And the trouble with Othello's ending is that it's completely predictable in terms of the sequence of events, not the poetry, not the style, but in terms of what actually happens. He gets jealous, he gets mad at her, he kills her, he finds out, he kills himself. And it's kind of leisurely. It doesn't have the electric force, I don't think, of Don Carlos. Now let's just do number 8 before the break, because this is a summation, which is going to be heavily influenced by the quality of the plot theme. What is the story you most like? The story. A story is a beginning, a middle, and an end. Obviously, you have to get into it. It has to intrigue you. It has to grip you and wring you out and leave you washed out or exalted at the end. And I think, for the reasons that I've mentioned, that the two best stories are Le Cid or Mona Vana, with the edge, as I've stated, to Le Cid. Now, the others, however expertly told, simply as story, are comparatively simple. Antigone defies the dictator. Othello gets mad at his wife. Dr. Stockman defies society. Joan defies the establishment, etc. And on the other side, Don Carlos isn't simple enough. He's constantly changing his mind about who he wants to be in love with, so it's not in focus enough. All right, I'll give you a minute. Comment or contest what I had to say on the issue of plot and story. I wiped you out. Okay, well, let's try to take a 4-minute break. All right, we're going to pick up now with question 9. We're looking at 12:45 now, if I talk nonstop. Either that or I can leave out some of the questions. What's that? Which play presents the most complex or intriguing theme? I would say Othello and Don Carlos. Because the other themes are all the themes reduced to simply the importance of X, whatever it happens to be. Antigone, the importance of the individual, or of the individual moral judgment. Le Cid, the importance of honor. Enemy of the people, the importance of truth. Joan, the importance of greatness. Mona Vana, the importance of personal love. These are all excellent themes, but they're simple one-line value statements. As against, Don Carlos is not merely the importance of freedom as against dictatorship, which would be a conventional theme on the order of the others. What makes it so intriguing is it's the importance of freedom as against selfishness, which makes this an unusual, very philosophical, and horrible theme, but nevertheless, it certainly is complex and intriguing. Now, Othello has an even more complex theme, because it's the irrelevance of virtue and vice to life, the self-destructiveness of any intense value. And this is much more difficult and complicated to dramatize fully than simply a theme on the order of the importance of X. And yet Shakespeare does it perfectly. He shows us vice and virtue and mixed characters and major characters and minor characters and integrates all of it to this relentless theme. So he's expert at taking a complicated idea. Now, it's interesting that the two most intriguing themes that I just mentioned are the most corrupt themes. And here we have again the tragedy of the good in history having no real philosophic basis. The great artists in history who were good men, basically, had no philosophic base to work with. And they had to content themselves, in effect, with simple affirmations of a value. Whereas the evil or corrupt had profound philosophic systems behind them. And they could venture dazzling, complicated ideas. They are at home intellectually with philosophy and ideas in a way that the better playwrights are not. And that leads us directly to 10. With which play do you most strongly agree or disagree? Now, speaking of an objectivist audience, this is cut and dry. The play you most strongly agree with is Enemy of the People. Thematically. And the play we most strongly disagree with is Othello. The three worst playwrights philosophically are Shakespeare, Schiller, who was a reincarnation of Kant, and Shaw. That's the three worst ones. Although Shaw's philosophy in St. Joe and this creative evolution is not clearly explicit in the play. The two best playwrights philosophically of our seven are Ibsen and Maeterlinck, and at least given the selections that I chose. And especially Ibsen, because Maeterlinck's play is not philosophical. And then we have two mixed playwrights. By mixed, I mean they have substantial elements of truth and of error. And that would be Sophocles and Corneille, Antigone and Lysippe. Why do I think Shakespeare is the most I disagree with him the most? Because Schiller at least purports to value reason and freedom. Whereas Shakespeare anathematizes all values. Why do I agree with Ibsen the most? Because aside from relatively minor errors, as when he gets trapped in evolution, his play is could have come straight out of objectivism. Now, Maeterlinck doesn't reach definition as a total philosophy, either in Monavon or anywhere else. All right, now let's get to 11. Which play most admirably integrates plot and theme? Now, by the word admirable here, I realize that is a shorthand, but we had to get the questions on one page. I'm trying to suggest that integration, as it's being viewed in this question, is a feat, F-E-A-T, a unique aesthetic virtue that implies complexity. Of course, theme and plot, meaning and action, have to be integrated in any proper work of art. But a simple value judgment reflected in a single event or a simple straight line story may be perfectly integrated, but it is not a feat of integration. For instance, suppose my theme is the value of persistence, and my story is a student sits at his desk studying, and he refuses telephone offers to go to the movies. He's persistent, and then he gets an A in the course. Huh? That is certainly integration of theme and story. But we are not in the big leagues aesthetically here, because the theme and plot are just too easy in one line. Now, Othello qualifies here as an admirable integration of plot and theme because of the complexity of the theme, and therefore the difficulty, the sheer intellectual difficulty, our artistic difficulty of integrating that theme to the plot line. And we saw how Shakespeare does it brilliantly on both the positive and the negative side across the spectrum of characters. Now, Lysippe also qualifies here as an admirable integration because he has a more ingenious plot theme, a more twisted plot theme, but a less complex theme. So his integration of plot and theme is admirable, although I think it's somewhat easier than Othello because his abstract theme is easier. Nevertheless, he does the integration through a complicated storyline with supreme skill. In all the twists of the raging conflicts, from the Ximena and Rodrigo and the father and the other father and the king and the Infanta, all the characters, major and minor, the theme is what breathes life and motivates the action. Now, the other plays I don't think have as admirable an integration simply because they're not as complex either in plot or in theme. Enemy is too simple a theme and story to be the very top rank of integration here. And the same for Shaw. He has, of course, complex intellectual disquisitions, but that doesn't mean a complex theme. His theme is the importance of greatness. And both Antigone and Don Carlos have weaknesses in the actual telling of the story, which take away from focused integration. Antigone, as you know, has the switch from Antigone to Creon as the focal point, which tends to give it a diffuse or not fully integrated air. And Don Carlos has the switch in the middle of the play from one triangle to the second, which is really harmful from the point of view of integration. Integration means everything belongs to one. Aristotle gives us an analogy to a living organism. You couldn't take any organ or element or tissue away without the thing dying. And a real play that has total integration has to be that way. From any one part, you should be able, in theory, to reconstruct the whole once you see the genius who presented it. Now, I think third on the level of integration of plot and theme after Othello and Le Cid would be Mona Vanna, because it has an ingenious plot, but again, it's less complex a work, fewer characters, much fewer ideas, less depth and richness. And now we reach the final awards. Number 12. Purely aesthetically, which is objectively the best play? Now here we have to review and marshal the evidence that we have already collected and then throw in a few more things that we didn't and then try and put it all together and see if something emerges. I'm doing this as not so much that I'm eager to push a certain play down your throat as dogma, but so you get an idea how to go about approaching these type of questions. Let's look at characters first. And here I just want to remind you of what we've already said. The three best characterizations are Antigone, Le Cid, and Iago. I think these three have the strongest, most powerful impact. They're completely real. They have the force of a locomotive. And that's a very important aesthetic achievement, as against more mixed or more ordinary characters, such as Don Carlos or Posa. Or as against characters of enormous stature, but with a comedic or farcical overtone or background, such as Dr. Stockman or Joan. Or as against less developed characters, which are delimited to a more conventional situation, like Mona Vanna. So the three I mentioned are the three great characterological portraits in our plays, and to that extent qualify their play as in the running for greatness, for the top greatness aesthetically. Now, another consideration is plot theme. And there, as I won't repeat, just the fact that I think Le Cid or Mona Vanna wins on that front. Best climax. That is a very eloquent indication of dramatic power and the power of artistry. because the climax is to a play what it is to sex. It's foreplay and afterplay, but that's the moment. So it's really a powerful contributor to your final assessment. And here I think Othello takes the prize for the reasons I've said. Most complex or intriguing theme. There, as I've said, I would put Othello or Don Carlos. Now, unfortunately, I have to consider another factor which we haven't discussed yet. What is the greatest in style? Well, that's the big unknown. Not only because we have never worked out canons of style in a systematized way, but because it can't be judged in translation. And basically five or six, if you count Shakespeare, of our plays, we read only in translation. But I'm going to try to suggest an answer within limits, taking for granted that we're comparing all works in English. Now, by style here, I mean use of language. A play is dialogue. It's people talking. So style really means the way people talk in the play. And what I demand is a playwright who exploits the full potential of language. Not merely the use of language to communicate character and action, which goes without saying, but a use of language which is pleasurable and fulfilling by its very texture and quality. A use which stretches language itself to show us the value and power possible to language and to the linguistic medium. Now, for example, take Oscar Wilde, a playwright not in this course. He uses language brilliantly in the specific form of epigrammatically. And that is something of value over and above character and plot, although necessarily subordinate and has to be integrated to them, but it's a unique pleasure and aesthetic value in his work. Now, several of our playwrights share this kind of quality. There are passages of brilliant dialogue where one character tops another in formulations which epigrammatically capture their view, or they top another character by a small change in wording or syntax, and the whole thing has the force of verbal linguistic pyrotechnics. I think a perfect example of that is Hymen and Creon arguing in Antigone. There's a breathtaking interchanges there. Or, of course, the Grand Inquisitor scene in the Schiller play is another fantastic example, and even deeper and more philosophical. Now, related to this category is intellectual wit, the ability to deal caustically and incisively with complex issues, is a great literary stylistic value. And of course, Shaw is a master at that, as, for instance, the Archbishop's definition of miracle. Now, some of the other plays don't have these outstanding features. Mona Vanna, for instance, has elevated, eloquent language, but no special linguistic value that I can see beyond that. It doesn't have the verbal genius of Shaw or the brilliant pyrotechnics of Schiller. Enemy of the People has simple, eloquent dialogue, fully appropriate to its characters, but I have no experience of relishing the use of language like a cat rolling in catnip. Now, of course, I don't know Norwegian. And similarly, the few fragments of Greek I know are not enough to give me a clue to judge Sophocles' use of language. But I do have some rudiments of French. And on this basis, I award the best style Oscar. That's not yet the best aesthetic, but just simply for style, which is one element of aesthetics, because also character and plot, etc., come in. The best style Oscar, I couldn't choose between Othello and Lassie. And my criterion for picking these two is that they are the most beautiful. Not only eloquent, dramatic, incisive, but beautiful in the sense of pure poetry, down to rhyme or meter, with the unique power of poetry to convey emotion. These two plays, by their style, have a haunting power, an ability to create mood, an impact purely from language that I think is unmatched by the others. Now, perhaps Antigone in the original Greek has this power. I doubt that any of the others does, even in the original. Now, am I saying all great plays must be poetry? No. But I do say this much. I venture out on a limb to this extent. If everything else is equal, then a play which is immortal poetry, fully integrated with the work, not extraneously introduced, is an added plus, a unique aesthetic bonus that has to be taken into account in judging the work's aesthetic and emotional value. Now, of course, if you're in this modern, moderno-centric predicament, you have been brought up to believe that poetry is, quote, artificial, which it is, just exactly the way everything good in art is artificial. You've been told that poetry is unreal, that's not the way people speak, etc., etc. It's boring. If you think this, you have been brainwashed by a bad culture and bad schooling, and it's cut and dry. You may not like a given poem, but if you're turned off to poetry as such, you just do not know what is out there and what power language can have directly on emotions. Poetry is a supreme form, not necessarily the, but a supreme form of exploiting the full resources of the literary medium. So, with this brief, fairly dogmatic excursion, I conclude that stylistically, which is one of several aesthetic counts, Shakespeare and Corneille come out as pretty much tied, and Sophocles is a real possibility, I just don't know enough to know. It's interesting, too, that Frenchmen hate Shakespeare because they don't know English that well. And Englishmen don't like Corneille because they don't know French that well. And so, really, to come to a purely objective judgment, you would have to be completely fluent in both. But I have had the experience of hearing sections of Le Cid read by a 17th century French expert. And it is thrilling. I mean, with the following the text in French, thrilling. Poetically speaking. Now we're closing in for the kill on the question of aesthetically, which is the best. Art is an integration of all the elements and detail, not merely of theme and plot, but the best total integration and thus the most unified work. And here I refer you to my most recent book where I discussed the criterion of integration. Now let's do it by elimination again. By the standard of integration, the storyline changes too much in Antigone. Don Carlos is two plays, therefore out of focus. Plus, the Grand Inquisitor is not integrated into the plot situation. Shaw has this uneasy union of tragedy and farce, and therefore it's not fully unified. It's not like a lens onto a single reality. Mona Vanna, an enemy of the people, have no objective flaws in integration, but they're comparatively simpler works, like Antigone, simpler stories or themes, fewer developed characters, fewer stylistic values, in other words, less to integrate. Therefore, in the sense of integration as an admirable feat, uniting a rich complexity into a unity, the two best, I say, are Othello and Le Cid. They are unbroken, unbreached in their integration of every detail, and they have a complex wealth to integrate on every level. Now, you see, I'm resting here as a conclusion on our earlier analysis. which play has the best features and which integrates them best. And therefore, my conclusion is that the best, taking into account all aesthetic elements and only aesthetic elements, is Othello and La Cid. These two plays represent mastery of every aspect of the art form. In other words, the greatest mastery of the means in order to create the most focused and unified end. Or in other words, question 12, the one we're doing now, amounts to which artist best uses all the elements of drama to portray and make real his type of universe? Which is the most potent and inescapable recreations of reality from the author's perspective? Now, all of the plays in this course, by definition, are great. But these two are utterly flawless and fully matured. Explicitly metaphysical in scope, with the complete exploitation of the medium to create a total universe. Not just to suggest a universe a la Maeterlinck by concretizing one element, but creating the whole universe for you to step into. In these two plays, we actually perceive and walk into a full reality, which is the task of great art. Now, if I have to look at the other end of this spectrum and say, which of our great plays is the least good aesthetically? I would say again, all are great, but then I would either add Joan or Don Carlos as being noticeably less than perfect. Joan, because of the multiple inconsistencies of Shaw. Don Carlos, in this particular play, because Schiller is better in other plays, but none of them have that ending, you see, because of its major failure of integration and excessive length. Antigone is potentially superlative, but the theatrical form had not yet developed enough for complex plots and multiple characterizations. And Enemy of the People, as I've said repeatedly, is a great play, but not as demanding and complex a work. As to if you put a gun to my head and choose between La Cid versus Othello, on purely aesthetic grounds, if I had to speak at the price of death, I would choose Shakespeare. But I can't do it, really, because I don't know French as well as I know English, so it's natural I would be biased in favor of Shakespeare. All right, now we get to 13, the easiest question. Philosophically, which is objectively the best play? Now, I did not mean which is the most or the least philosophical play. If I had meant that, Schiller is the most philosophical. Maeterlinck is the least. What I meant by the question is which play is philosophically closest to the truth? So it's really the same as an earlier question. The answer is Enemy of the People. Philosophically, it's the best. And which play is the least true, judging by objectivism? Without a doubt, as we've said, Othello. Of all of our playwrights, if I could, you know, summon them down from heaven, where they undoubtedly are, I mean, if they go anywhere, they all seven of these men went to heaven. There's only three that I would want to talk philosophy with. Who would you want to talk philosophy with? Sophocles, Corneille, and Ibsen. All three I would expect to be open, intelligent, and interested. Shakespeare and Schiller I project as being closed to argument. Maeterlinck you couldn't pin down, he would jump all over the place. And Shaw would be like Bertrand Russell. And I think it reflects this fact that the best works philosophically are the works of the three that you would most want to talk to, with Ibsen's play being the least contradicted by wrong ideas. And that brings us to number 14. The best play, taking both art and philosophy into account. And this is a really, really difficult question now, because what do you do How do you integrate both of those into an objective assessment since they're basically independent factors? You can be great on one and lousy on the other and vice versa. Now, obviously, to be the best as a total, each of them must reach a certain minimum level, art and philosophy. And then we've got to see what we've got. We have to, first of all, give philosophy its proper due when we're counting both art and philosophy. We know you can't equate philosophy with art. And that's why Othello can be greater aesthetically than Enemy of the People. But you cannot ignore the fact that philosophy counts toward the verdict on the total. Here I remind you of Ayn Rand's point that art is a composite of means and ends, or as I put it in my book, of mastery and truth, or another way of saying it, of aesthetic standards and philosophic validity. So if we're talking about the best as a total, there are some works you can eliminate objectively simply on the grounds that the philosophy in them is utterly corrupt, without a redeeming note. And in such a case, however expert the work is in terms of its means, it is debarred from the status of best work as a total. A brilliant means to portray utter falsehood disqualifies the work in this competition. It can still be great, great as a total, and I think all seven that I chose are great, but it can't be the very top, it can't be the greatest as a total if the heart of its meaning is corrupt. And for these reasons, I disqualify two playwrights out of hand as having the best as a total, and that is Shakespeare and Schiller. They're just too awful intellectually to put them on the topmost exalted rank. Now, on a somewhat different grounds, we can get rid of Shaw. Now, his philosophy in the play is not nearly as bad as Shakespeare or Schiller, who just beat you mercilessly over the head with corruption. Shaw has some valid elements in his philosophy, but the problems are multiple with Shaw on strictly philosophic grounds. His ideas are pretty shaky, this, you know, voluntaristic German-type metaphysics. His ideas, worse, are inherently ambivalent and contradictory, which is really bad for a work which is supposed to concretize and make real your ideas. And on top of that, his broader philosophy is not fully integrated to or even presented in his play. It's just the tip of the iceberg in the play. You have to read his preface to really get what he's after. And as a further expression of his ambivalence or oscillation is the fact that he oscillates from farce to tragedy and back. So I would say, if we're talking about the greatest as a total work, Shaw is disqualified. Not for having a thoroughly corrupt philosophy, but basically for having a philosophy inadequately defined and integrated into his work. And now Mona Vanna is out here because it's simply not philosophical enough for the present league. We've already covered that. So that leaves us with three plays which still can qualify as objectively the best after the philosophic test has been passed. And those three are Antigone, Le Cid, and Enemy of the People. Each has a focused, definite view of the universe, expertly integrated to the concretes of their artistic recreation. Now, the choice between these is not self-evident. You can't say, well, Enemy is truer, whereas Antigone and Le Cid have only elements of truth, therefore Enemy is the best. because you're talking then purely philosophically, and we are trying to judge here best as a total. So we have to add the aesthetic element. Let's go back. Which of these three is better purely aesthetically? Well, Antigone has the best characterization. In my opinion, even better than Lysippe. If I had to forget one of those characters, I'd never forget Antigone. But Lysippe has a better plot situation, more complex and ingenious than Antigone. And those are the two crucial elements to get us under the wire. Now, Enemy drops out here as a contender because it doesn't reach the level of colossal characterization or ingenious plot situation. In this company, it's just simply a little too, quote, naturalistic in terms of people and events, although I would definitely rank it as third from the top as objectively the best play as a total. But number one and two are some order, Antigone or Lysippe. And here, the way I reason is, Antigone is drama at its earliest stage, before having a chance to develop the complexities of a sophisticated plot. And to be perfectly frank, I understand French somewhat, and therefore Corneille's style more than I can ever hope to understand Sophocles' style. But even trying to leave that aside, Othello and Lysippe are the best aesthetically. And now we have to choose between Antigone and Lysippe, which are about on a par intellectually. Both are a mixture of heroic philosophy undercut by the same error, namely intrinsicism in some form. And I say, therefore, this is the situation we have. Lysippe is tied for the best intellectually within the final competitors. And it's tied for the best aesthetically. It's the only finalist in both categories. And this is a lot more than they give you at the Tonys. I therefore conclude that as a total, Lysippe is the best play, taking both art and philosophy into account. Now you see, I've picked three different plays for three different questions. Othello is the best aesthetically. Enemy of the People is the best philosophically. Lysippe is the best as a total. And I deliberately, one of the reasons for choosing these plays is to concretize for you that these are not the same question and to give you an idea how to approach objective judgment, how to first distinguish art from philosophy and then how to integrate them at the end. And I hope that this does give you at least an indication of how to do it. Which brings us to the last question. Which of the seven is your personal favorite? Now, why is there room for this? We've already analyzed everything in the work. It's art, it's philosophy, their relationship. Because there is room for personal and cultural factors that weigh heavily in your own soul and life, even though they're not appropriate to a purely objective appraisal. And as long as you know to keep them on the side, it's perfectly legitimate to feel them and express them. As long as you know that's a different category. You're talking about an association you have, a personal experience you have, a desperate need you happen to have at this point in your life. As long as you see that you're bringing a personal factor that may be a perfectly legitimate factor, but it's not simply inherent in looking at the art form and saying, is this great? Now, personally, I am torn between Lysippe and Antigone as my favorites, with Enemy of the People as third. But I have an edge in favor of Antigone as my personal favorite, even though Lysippe is more sophisticated and more developed. And I would name a couple of factors as being the personal reasons involved. One is my association of Antigone with Ayn Rand. And my own life happened to be tremendously molded by a woman like Antigone. And it's very hard for me to read a play that has someone like her and say, oh, I really feel closer to another play. That is not obligatory. And I would never venture to put that forth in an aesthetic or philosophic discussion, because that would mean if I didn't know her personally, you know, my objective judgments would change. But it certainly is relevant to my personal reaction. Another personal factor involved is that I love Greek culture over everything succeeding it. And this Antigone is our only pre-Christian play. And I like the fact that it's so early, so pagan, gives me personally a thrill as an onlooker observing mankind's history that no post-Christian play can do unless it were utterly to repudiate religion in the Christian way, which of course Le Cid does not do. Now again, that test is hardly mandatory or requisite. It just happens that in my life work, the big divide is before and after Jesus, with everything being downhill since that time. And therefore, the fact that this brings back Greece and Ayn Rand is just too powerful. I mean, for me personally, it pushes it over. Now, I must admit that in some moods, I liked Le Cid best personally too, precisely because of its greatness, and also because it is so much happier than Antigone. It's an enchanting picture, I think, of human life. And I have to say that in some moods I like Enemy of the People best because it's right. And I don't have to sigh and abstract away from falsehoods and say, okay, forgetting this and forgetting religion and forgetting feudalism and forgetting... You can just read exactly what they say without rewriting it and just give yourself to it. Now, I know when I feel that I'm being swamped by intellectual considerations, but as long as I know it, that's okay. Now, many of you undoubtedly like Mona Vanna the best personally. Am I right? Let me see by a show of hands. That's what I thought. I don't, because it's not philosophically enough for what I personally want in a play. But if you do it, I understand that perfectly and approve. And Mona Vanna is by far the most benevolent, the most romantic sense of life, and therefore the most sheer pleasure to experience. If you are starved for exactly that experience, who can fault you for responding to it? I certainly can't and don't. Now, some of you undoubtedly picked Enemy of the People as your most personal. Can I see? Yes. Now, this is the only one of our seven plays that's a modern play set in the modern era. So there's no question this is the easiest play to follow. And it's probably the easiest for you to identify with in concrete terms, because in your own life, you presumably stand up to society regularly, where you don't lead armies, take on the Arabs, defy kings, etc. So it's understandable if you find Enemy of the People your personal favorite. I don't criticize that, but I do want to stress again that if you are content to stop at that level, you are losing out on the great values ready and waiting for you in the Western canon. You are making easy accessibility your operative standard, and thereby stunting your growth. Ideally, you should reach the point where you can surmount these obstacles of accessibility and pick your personal favorite with an easy grasp of all the greatness that the West has to offer, rather than because you have no time or knowledge to do anything but to pick up what is immediately familiar and identifiable with. All right, now I just want to make a few brief concluding remarks, and then I have some interesting questions already written out. A few concluding remarks. We finished our exercise now. What can you learn from objective evaluation? I think there's an analogy here in regard to judging people. It's the difference between responding blindly to some person as a package deal, as against analyzing and evaluating objectively in conscious terms. Why is it essential in dealing with people to judge objectively? Well, you want to know who are you dealing with and what action is appropriate in the future. Well, these same considerations apply to judging art objectively. If you analyze the elements of an artwork and evaluate them objectively, one great result is you know what you are observing. You know what it is and your values. You know exactly what you want in art by the nature of your evaluations. And you're therefore able to seek out deliberately in the future what you want and then enjoy it consciously and fully, rather than merely react blindly with no idea of what you're responding to or where else to look for more. Part of objective evaluation is that you see the full work. You see it with the kind of tremendous clarity. Just as in regard to people, your analysis reveals the essence of the person and not just out-of-context aspects. Now, after today, hopefully, you see each of these plays even more sharply and clearly than you did when we were just simply analyzing them. You see them for, I hope, the virtues they offer and for their limitations, if any. And you feel freer now if I say to you out of the blue, is Joan a great characterization? Your mind can say something like, well, by comparison to, say, a bromidic heroine like, what's her name in Wuthering Heights? I tried all day to think of it. Kathy what? Earnshaw, right. By comparison to Kathy Earnshaw in Wuthering Heights, St. Joan is a great characterization. But in comparison to Antigone, that is not the equal. In other words, you can relish the combination of values that one play has to offer, and you can put your finger exactly on what inhibits your admiration of another. You can tell which of the problems with the play is caused by your own ignorance and how to remedy it, and which problems flow from the play and where to look for better ones in that regard. In other words, you become your own master in the realm of art, knowing your values, recognizing and relishing their full expression, having the whole field at your fingertips and in your control. It's the same as the difference between having an implicit and an explicit philosophy with all the power of the explicit. Once you know your objective evaluation of the key aspects of a play, you can proceed to milk your pleasures systematically. You can go to the used bookstores, but above all, the university libraries where they can still be found, and find great plays or poems or novels in abundance. And please, I hope I've made clear, the authors do not have to be objectivist or modern in order to offer you the greatest values possible. All of our 7 plays, in one form or another, offer moral values and human passion, riveting conflict, individualism, self-assertion, the strength of a man or a woman, heroism, free will, the logic of plot, brilliantly eloquent language, exalted aspiration, high drama, philosophic depth, and the exhilaration of the sheer pleasure of great art. I hope I've been able to communicate these values and above all their abundant availability to you. I hope that if and when you run out of satisfying art that is easy to get at, you have an idea now of where to look for buried treasure. Paraphrasing John Galt, it is real, It is possible. It's yours if only you dig it up. I want to say that I've enjoyed this course. I love this subject matter. I've enjoyed this course more than anything I've given so far. It's just pure pleasure to me. And I want to thank you all very much for having the interest to come such long distances and attend these lectures and for being such a responsive audience. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And we're just exactly at our time, but I have some written questions that I don't want to pass by. These are real questions, not ones that I made up. But they're all worth commenting on, so we can go for it. George, can we go for another 15 minutes? Okay. This question came in a while ago, and I saved it for now. Not that I have an answer, but several times during the lectures, you have pointed out the beauty and majesty of the language, such as the line from Lacide, "Half my life has put the other half in the grave." Could you please talk about what epistemological principles distinguish a momentous and moving line from a run-of-the-mill one? Now, that is a whopper. I mean, you want not only a treatise on style, but I should derive everything stylistically from the essence of human epistemology. And if I could do that, I would be writing the book. I'll just tell you some considerations that make a great line to me. That's the most I can answer. Originality of the thought. Not that it has to be profound, but the idea of half your life bearing the other half is a thought, an angle on something that I had never thought of looking at before. So it's an original thought. See, the line has to be content and form. That combination is what has to get you. The brevity, the condensation, is crucial to the Crow epistemology. If he had said something like, "A great value in my existence, something that I have treasured, has wrecked another great value, something that I equally treasured. I don't know how I'll live one," and it just went on and on like that. It's dead. But if this is half my life, has put in the grave the other half. It's the sheer condensation. It's just a few eloquent words and it's a whole volume. It's the simplicity in the expression of the complex is what makes great art. Then the use of metaphor to concretize, to make something vivid. And remember, art is the reduction to the perceptual. And here you see the grave. And a terrific line that I mentioned before is, "Your daughter and Othello are now making the beast with two backs." You could never, for as long as you lived, not see that once that metaphor is put there. Sheer wit. Shaw's line, "Don't do unto others, you know, as you would have others do unto you, because their tastes may be better than yours," is an immortal line for sheer wit. I love epigrams. Sometimes rhythm, in the right moment, in the right context, a short line can be extremely effective. The unexpected clash, or the unexpected, the double meaning. The best in this course, I think, of that, the very simplest line, which on the face of it has, I could no longer tell, is completely without, you know, wit or et cetera, and yet in the context when we have the mighty king before the blind inquisitor, and he says, "Are you the king?" And he says, "Yes." And he says, "I could no longer tell." And if that's delivered correctly, right away, you figure, that is like a knife in the heart of the king. It's a fabulous line, and yet it's five words without anything except the context that gives it the powerful double meaning. Those are some of the considerations. And as I say, if I could give you a systematic list, I would be in business as a writer about style. But try and notice those things when you read. Every line that you can relish is that much more pleasure that you can extract from the work. Now, where is that question? I've got the answer here and not the question. I can't believe I put the question away. Here it is. Good question. I'm enjoying your analysis of the seven plays. I'll just cut this a bit. I'd like to select another 7 to 10 plays on my own, read them applying the six-step method you taught us. Without any guidance, I'd probably select another play by each of the playwrights from this course, but I'd rather read plays which you suggest. Can you suggest other great underscored plays worth the time and effort? For example, were there other plays which nearly made it into this course but were cut for lack of time? Now, let me tell you that first that I think this is a really good idea, and several people that I know in different places around the country are forming a kind of play of the month club in which they're going to read one play a month, and one person is responsible for doing the guided tour through the play. And if you get 12 people in your group, you only have to prepare one play a year and read the others. It makes a great social evening. You can do the thing in an hour or two. It's stimulating. You have the fun of other people helping you out if you get stuck. And if you like plays, I strongly recommend that to you just as a social activity. Now you want me to list a whole bunch of great plays that I didn't cover. I'm going to give you a lot here, but I don't say they're all great. And to be tell the truth, I'm not that knowledgeable in the history of the theater. It's only within the, I've always liked certain plays, and then I started reading more methodically in the last year when I finally decided I had enough of philosophy. But I really do not know enough, so I can give you some suggestions, and you're going to have to decide. Browse through some of these suggestions. If your interest is piqued, okay, and if not, there's still lots of others. Now, I would try one from each of the famous Greek writers. From Aeschylus, Prometheus Bound, you have to like. It's not a full play. I can't give you a comment on each of these because I only have 5 minutes. It's not a full play, but it's really dramatic. From Sophocles, Aristotle thought Oedipus was his best. From Euripides, try Medea. From Aristophanes, the comedian, The Clouds is his famous satire of intellectuals, in which he lumps Socrates and the sophists together as idiots. Now, where's Bob Mayhew? What was the name of the Aristophanes one that you told me about, which was a satire of communism? Can you spell that? E-Z-C-L-E-S. I-A-Z-U-E. Ecclesia. Well, whatever. All right. I don't know it at all, but he says it's an interesting satire of communism. Now, unfortunately, I just don't know Roman drama well enough, so I can't make suggestions there. For a medieval play, I would recommend Abraham and Isaac. A truly awful theme. But if you want to know what it is to live as a medieval, this is the story of what Abraham goes through when he decides to kill his son for God. Now, jumping to the Elizabethan, it's anonymous. You'll get it in any collection of medieval plays. The other famous one is Everyman, but that's not so interesting. Now, for Elizabethan plays, anything of Shakespeare, if you can take it. The one that I don't know, and I'm very well, but I have advanced reason to believe is probably one of his best, is King Lear. So I would plunge. I hate Hamlet. I can't stand Macbeth. But King Lear, the theme is something I can more closely identify with, which is out of rage out of control. So maybe that'll be. Maybe you would enjoy that. Also, don't overlook Christopher Marlowe, a contemporary of Shakespeare. I had a lot of fun reading Dr. Faustus, a badly flawed play, but a real window onto the aspirations of the Renaissance man and the Christian guilt that he still felt for aspiring. Now I got to jump to Corneille. Read a lot of him because it's really good. Particularly, don't ask me for the pronunciation, but the two that I was torn about including are Polyeucte. I think that's how you spell it. Polyeucte. That's about an atheist. And I was really torn as to whether who is a Cornelian hero. And the other is Cinna, C-I-N-N-A. A fascinating play set in ancient Rome, which raises moral issues. I was just set to pick Cinna, and then I thought, no, they've got to have a happy ending or they're going to be a mass rebellion. So I switched to Lucide, and I'm glad I did, but you shouldn't miss Cinna. Now, Racine and Molière, the other two French, I don't like at all. So read them at your own peril. Now, switching to Germany, Goethe's Faust. Of course, you already know the story, but Goethe is not to be sneezed at. Schiller actually has written better plays, although, because this was a youthful one of his, but nothing like the end of Don Carlos. But you might find it very interesting to read The Maid of Orleans, which is Schiller's version of St. Joan. Because you could compare the same story in Shaw and Schiller. Also, Wallenstein by Schiller is an excellent play. A lot of his plays are excellent. Now, Ibsen. Just about everything in his final cycle is fascinating. I recommend particularly Master Builder and Hedda Gabler. I can't take The Doll's House simply because, you know, I always think of Gloria Steinem when I read it. Now, I just, by the way, here's a play I never heard of, but someone in the class said I would like it. It's by Machiavelli. In Italian, but translated. Mandragola, M-A-N-D-R-O-G-O-L-A. So if you want the recommendation of a completely unknown to me play. Now, getting back to more modern times, I'm very strong on Oscar Wilde as an excellent playwright. I once had the honor of writing a piece of fiction, which I showed Miss Rand. She thought it was very flawed, but she said, to me, she said, you are the Oscar Wilde of objectivism. And I've read everything of his. Of serious work, Salome. It'll give you an example of relishing language. The language itself is like an orgiastic experience. It's so exquisite. In terms of plot stories, I wouldn't know where to pick. Ideal Husband is wonderful. A Woman of No Importance is wonderful. Now, as far as his famous comedy is The Importance of Being Earnest, I can't say I ever went for that. But on the other hand, I have to say I do not know an objectivist that doesn't like it. So maybe it's just a personal aberration. Now, don't ignore either Terence Rattigan, who I think just recently died, or he might still be, is he still alive? Is he still alive, Gloria? Anyway, he wrote some really excellent plays, but they're one-note plays. He's not a philosophic writer, but he wrote at least two wonderful plays, both of which have been made into utterly superlative movies. One is The Winslow Boy, and the other is The Browning Version. Two 5-star movies, if you can get a hold of them. You just can't beat that as a movie experience. Also, don't forget Noel Coward. Now, he writes on a more popular and comedic level, but his plays are always enjoyable, witty. Private Lives is a charming drawing room comedy. Now, don't forget Shaw, some of his other plays. And besides the one we read, I seriously debated Pygmalion, The Devil's Disciple, of which an excellent movie has been made, and the one that I was on the verge of choosing was Man and Superman. But I didn't, because it's even longer than the Schiller play. But it has an interlude in it called Don Juan in Hell, where Don Juan and the devil have like a 50 to 75 page debate, which is really fascinating and brilliant. And I just didn't have the strength to try to cram that in, but at your leisure, that makes a terrific play to read. Rostand, a wonderful playwright. Cyrano de Bergerac, one of the top plays of all time ever. I think it's my personal top favorite play I've ever written. I only left it out of this course because everybody knows it. But it is, Rostand wrote a lot of others, including Chanticleer. And now I'm just going to conclude here because we're running out of time, but there is several French playwrights. I'm just going to give you the name and you just go and browse. Scribe. S-C-R-I-B-E. I think he wrote 150 plays, all forgotten today. Mostly comedies. Sardou, S-A-R-D-O-U. And of course, Victor Hugo. Now, I'm making the following offer with great tentativeness. If you really are interested, I mean, you have the passion like, you know, the top characters here. I happen to have a list that I got from a graduate student in theater at the University of Minnesota, which lists from prehistory on through current all the important plays, at least in the opinion of this department, from beginning to end. It's pages long. If you're lost, if you tried some of my selections and you just don't know what to do, write to me at Box 177, Murray Hill Station, New York, New York, with just a line to earn a Xerox of this list. You got to say something about what you read or why you want or why the course helped you or why it harmed you. Some one provocative line. And that'll justify us in having to Xerox and mail this to you. Now remember, this is somebody else's list, which is pages long. It is not great plays by my standard. It's all plays. But it'll give you something to work with. Now, I'm going to use the last 2 minutes, I'm sorry, on this question, which I do want to say something about. I want to know more about the course you are working on. And that's going to be my swan song for today. And briefly speaking, I have, I believe, completed my intellectual evolution. from philosophy through literature, and I have now discovered that the thing that really interests me about literature is the ability to evoke and create the whole historic period. And I suddenly occurred to me just about 3 or 4 months ago, wouldn't it be great just to study history, which I was never interested in my entire life. And I acquired this tremendous interest because now I have the context of a strong interest in concretes and reality rather than general abstractions. And basically what I would like to do with the remainder of my creative years is do for the world as a whole what I did for one decade in Germany in my first book. In other words, show philosophy as the integrating explanatory power that moves the world. So basically the idea would be from Adam to Clinton. And where are we now, and what can we expect? All of that integrated from the point of view of philosophy. Now, I realize that's highly specialized, but I'm starting to read history voraciously now, and I hope to start teaching pure history, history, not the history of philosophy and not the history of literature, but I mean kings and battles and, you know, the stuff that everybody hates. I'm going to start teaching that hopefully next spring in one format or another, which you will hear about. And if all goes as planned, I will be on that subject for years to come. And that will be the subject of my next book. So you know as much basically about my thinking now as I do. And I'm sorry again for keeping you so late. Thank you very much. Do you want to speak?